Appreciate it. And we'll call our next case Work versus Danberg. Okay. Mr. Hampton.
Good morning, Your Honor. Stephen Hampton here on behalf of the appellate and apartment in the court.
How much?
Could you pull the microphone?
Yeah, you can just, the answer to that is, if you want 4 minutes, you can have 4 minutes for rebuttal. Go ahead.
Your Honor, this is a case in which the position of the appellant is that the way that the Department of Corrections is handling the releases in Delaware, that many inmates are being over-detained, and by over-detained we mean being held past the day that a court ordered them to be released, and in fact, not only are they held past that day, in some cases they're held weeks past that day.
Mr. Sure. Hampton, you took one deposition in this case, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Of Ms. McBride. And she recounted numerous ways in which she took steps to mitigate the over-detention problem, reacting to complaints, et cetera. What is there in the record that counters what she did and would allow us to find that she was deliberately indifferent?
Your Honor, the problem, I believe, with what she did is that she said, I tried different things, but there is no proof that any of them were effectual.
What's the proof that there wasn't? There's a burden on your part to show that they were ineffectual and that she was deliberately indifferent.
Your Honor, the individuals that we have listed as our plaintiffs and also as the additional inmates who were over-detained, we've listed them and they went on for several years, and there's been no evidence that that has been corrected. Also,
I made a summary and a chart of the named plaintiffs, and really it came down to six of them were conceded by her to have been Corps problems and error. Many of them were problems with just paperwork snafus in the courts or things that they really weren't over-detained. So I guess I'm trying to find the policy, the custom, whatever it was that you say is at the heart of this to show deliberate indifference on her part.
Your Honor, if I may, the deliberate indifference on her part, I believe, can be examined and thought of in several ways. First of all, is that she has not, despite the fact that she's known about these over-detentions, taken any steps to quantify them or any steps to quantify whether anything she did decreased the number of them. In fact, she said that she didn't even know how many complaints their office was getting about people who had been over-detained because she didn't keep those records. Part of the problem is the only cases that ever got to her were somebody who was a subordinate brought the problem to her.
We understand from your briefing, of course, and the record that you provided us, that there are problems, and how are we to reach the point you want us to reach, which is the deliberate indifference point, right? I mean, we've got Moore versus Tartler, where the court, quoting the district court in that case, said that an investigation, however slow and incompetent, was conducted. It may not work just the way you want, it may not be as effective or as efficient as you want, but there was activity, which appears to be good faith activity, to get improvement. In fact, the whole purpose for instituting CORE was to get an improvement. How can that be squared with deliberate indifference?
Your Honor, if I may, first of all, the reason for CORE was to have uniformity. It was not to improve performance. rather than to make sure that we're all on the same page. It wasn't improve speed.
I thought from the press release or the press interview that Commissioner Danberg had that one of the main reasons to have CORE in place was because you had people being released too soon and you had people in some instances being held too long, and they wanted to eliminate that. Wasn't that the character or tenor of his remarks?
Actually, Your Honor, I think it's a little more complex. What was happening is because the individuals were being released by the various institutions, what you had was different standards and different policies in each individual institution. So
the purpose of the uniformity was to make it operate more consistently, better than it had when people were just going off and doing things without coordination and letting people out too soon or holding them too late. That wasn't the driver behind this?
It was consistency as opposed to speed. That's what I'm trying to get at. What he did when he took all of the releases that used to be held at the individual facilities into one place.
Well, they weren't trying to make it consistently bad, right? They were trying to make it consistent in the sense of making it consistently right, correct. That is, you get out on the day you're supposed to get out. You don't get out early, and you don't get out late. You get out on the day you're supposed to get out. I mean, I'm surprised to hear you pushing back on that, because I thought that was sort of a point of agreement that they were trying to hit the mark and not undershoot or overshoot. You're disagreeing with that?
Well, Your Honor, in the press release itself, the problem that was being addressed was the early releases. That was a problem that was bringing heat over the Department of Corrections it was 19 or whatever the number was. So what they were concerned about primarily was the people that were being released too early, and part of that has to do with, I suppose, the skill and the training of the people doing the releasing and whether they actually looked at the background and looked at all of the appropriate computer sites to see if they were together.
But the real question here is, how do you get to the genuine dispute that you need to defeat summary judgment on this deliberate indifference issue if, when you look at Montanez and you say, was the action, that they took only ineffectual action. In point of fact, there were many actions taken. There's nothing in the record about them being severely ineffectual. You know, when you look at the total number of people being released, if it comes down to six people, based on the evidence that Judge Rendell's question asked, or 37, whatever the exact number is, that's probably less than 1%. So how do we? What is there for the genuine dispute?
First of all, Your Honor, on the people that were over detained, there are maybe five or six of them in which it was admitted by Rebecca McBride that it was clearly nothing but a problem with the central offender records. However, there were problems in all of the other cases, and a number of them, her answer was, well, we couldn't find the document that the courts should have sent us, so therefore we assume it's a problem in the court. We had the cases in which people, maybe it was a problem of the court, but they've gone weeks and days and days and days without anybody being able to address that because the inmates cannot tell anybody who has the authority to look it up. So we have inmates sitting in prison, their families are calling, the bail bondsmen are calling, everybody's calling. Why are they still sitting in prison? But they can't call Central Offender Records, which is the only people who can fix it.
Is that, by the way, has... And this is maybe slightly off the legal topic, but I'm curious to know, has this lawsuit resulted in any change in that problem? Do you know?
To my knowledge, it has not, Your Honor. And I would point out that in several of the cases that were mentioned, I think in the Barnes case and in the, I believe it's the Mortimer versus Baca, the 594 Fed 3rd 714 case in 2010, in both of those cases, the court pointed out all of the corrective activities that both Departments of Correction took and how they actually greatly reduced the number of people being over-detained. In this case, we have no evidence, first of all, that they ever quantified how many people were being over-detained, and second, that they took any steps that actually reduced that number.
Can I ask you a question about that issue? In the joint appendix at 779, at SEC, there are erroneous release figures for the years in question. I don't know whether, and early and held past, et cetera, I don't know whether these are, I mean, they're in evidence, but are these just from the prison's viewpoint and you dispute them, or what?
They are, Your Honor, what was produced by Rebecca McBride. However, when you questioned, she said the only early releases or the only open detentions that she was aware of was if one of her subordinates brought it to her attention. In fact, when we looked through the records, starting with Mr. Wharton, there were quite a few people that she never knew were already detained.
Well, but it is a supervisor liability, and it is has to do with what she did know.
Well, she knew people were being over-detained, but she didn't have her subordinates tell her when the people were being over-detained.
So does she have a policy of not permitting people to tell her? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the policy was they should tell me, but they don't.
Okay, well, but that's not a policy you shouldn't tell her. Which policy are you actually complaining about? Is it the cell phone policy? Or is it a policy of how she was dealing? What policy did she adopt that you're complaining about?
Well, I mean, part of the problem that she faces isn't necessarily her policies. It's because there's reduced hours and there's reduced...
Well, and there's 16,000 or 27,000 or there's just a lot of releases going.
Well, that's per year. I mean,
yeah, exactly. That's a lot per day.
Are you actually saying, because they're open 7 days a week, they're open on hours to take late into the night, is the plaintiff's position that unless the Corps operates 24/7, there's deliberate indifference?
In this case, I believe there is, and I would point to the Barnes case. And in the Barnes case, one of the reasons that the court held the Department of Corrections at fault was they had a rule where at 10 o'clock at night, nobody could be released until 5 or 7 the next morning. It was an arbitrary rule. And they said, you can't do that because you're now keeping people who should have been released from being released.
There was a lot of discovery, and there was an expert report extrapolating exactly what was going on. I mean, here you have one deposition, and you make a reference to being stonewalled or something in terms of discovery. Did you go to the district court and say, I need more discovery and ask the court to order it for you?
I did not, Your Honor. I pointed out to the Department of Corrections my feelings, but I did not go to the court. Did produce affidavits by people working in the system, both an employee, a jail bonds person, a public defender, and depositions of one of the other people who worked in the... So a deposition of somebody else who worked in the department. So the deposition wasn't taken purely for this case, but it was a deposition about these issues. The lady's name was Kara, right now I'm forgetting her last name, but in the appendix. So there is more than just McBride's deposition. There's also some depositions from other people who had other things to say about this problem.
Right. There's some affidavits.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Hampton. Mr. McTaggart. Even before you do that, let me ask you this. And do we even have to look at class certification here? If the court is correct about deliberate indifference, is class certification a moot point?
I believe it is, Your Honor. I believe it is. I think we cited some case law that I have said.
Okay. So then let's do stick with deliberate indifference.
Well, then let me ask you this question that will forego some other stuff. So... does that, if the district court is incorrect on the 14th Amendment analysis as it applies to pretrial detainees, can you likewise forego getting to class certification?
Your Honor, we addressed that in our brief, and I think the amicus brief cites to a case called Betts versus Newcastle, which says that the standard is essentially the same for the 8th Amendment claim and the 14th Amendment claim. It's still the deliberate indifference standard under Sample. So even though this the claims were not broken out by the district court.
Even though he didn't address it?
It's the same fact.
Okay.
And I think it's the same result. And as I read the briefs by the appellant, the argument is either that Danberg did nothing, or that Danberg worked to set up this system to make things worse. And we believe that the district court got it right, that that's not borne out by the record.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
If there's an increase, and so this is a question of the proposition, but if there were an increase in the over-detentions since 2008, wouldn't that by definition mean that the the action taken was ineffectual?
You know, I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. I think we still would have to go through the sample test and whether or not the actions of a specific supervisor, the policy of a supervisor, what the supervisor did, and whether or not there was a causal connection between the specific policy identified and whether or not that policy causally injured the specific plaintiff. These claims are very vague. They're hard to follow in terms of what the policy
Well, they may be hard to follow in terms of what maybe a specific policy here or there is, but I understand to be saying CORE doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And not only does it not work, it infects other things that the state points to the courts and blames the courts for the problems, but it's still CORE's got an influence and an infection, so to speak, throughout the system, and here are all the ways we can point to it. We've got a CORE employee, Tara Stewart, saying they're short-staffed and then, so their delays in release are regular. We got an affidavit from another CORE employee saying about 10% to 20% of release orders are not processed on the day they're supposed to. You've got the affidavit of the bail bondsman, Bruni Mercado, who says he posts bond and 25% of the people are held for more than 48 hours afterwards. You've got the public defender, Sandra Dean, who says it's gotten a lot worse since CORE. I can keep going, but you get the tenor. And then you get the defendant McBride, who acknowledges that there have been problems since implementing CORE. So if you take that record and you see coming from multiple sources, and by the way, I didn't see any record from the state saying, oh, those people are all wrong, or it's really not the case that Mr. Mercado's got a quarter of his clients being held 48 hours longer than they're supposed to. If that's actually the record, that it's hitting somewhere between a fifth and a quarter of people based on the CORE employee and the bail bondsman, wouldn't that suggest that the state's got a significant problem?
No, Your Honor. And we did address those affidavits in the brief. I mean, I think there are some issues with the specifics in those affidavits. For example, the one from the bail bondsman talks about when he posts bail. And it's a collective affidavit, how the office operates.
So you think there were fact issues?
I think there are fact issues.
Then shouldn't you lose summary judgment?
No, Your Honor. The bail's posted at the court. I mean, I think he's entitled to reasonable inferences, but that's not a reasonable inference that every time bail's posted at the court, that's a delay that's attributable to the Department of Corrections.
Well, help me on something more fundamental. If there are fact issues, then why don't you lose?
Your Honor, as the district court analyzed this, on the deliberate indifference, there was not evidence of deliberate indifference by either one of these defendants. And these same arguments were made in the district court.
But here's the problem, right? Tell me if this proposition is wrong, but if the number of over-detentions has increased over time, and the plaintiff submits what they submit, and, you know, we can argue about whether they should be more fulsome, detailed, whatever, but it's there. Why isn't that enough to create a genuine dispute of material fact?
You know, I don't believe that the numbers have increased over time. I think the numbers that are in the record.
What's in the record?
Record that we have from McBride is about five people that have been over detained over the course of discovery in this case.
Okay.
Out of about 44,000 releases.
Okay, so fine, five. Certainly what the plaintiff has put forward would lead one to conclude concretely that it's got to be more than five, right? I mean, there are whatever the number of affiants are, it's certainly not just a couple, each of whom are referring to instances, multiple instances, many of them, where there are over-detentions. So clearly, at least the presented the district court are in stark contrast to each other. Why aren't we mandated to just say, you know what, it's got to go back and it's got to be tried?
You're right. I still would say under sample of indeed, the plaintiff still has to prove that there was some specific policy that was enacted by these supervisors, so that the supervisors were deliberately indifferent as to the use of that policy, and the enforcement of that policy causally injured these individuals. And when you look at the...
That's the tenor of the question, I guess, you're getting from us, which is causality really so clear that there's no dispute of fact? You say it's only five people. When you parse this out, look, it's only five people. They say we've got people coming in here willing to testify that 10 to 20% from your own core employees, 25% from a bail bondsman, some substantial increase not defined by a public defender, are being over-detained. We've got people that say that, and we've got your evidence that says something different. Are those factual disputes? And if they're factual disputes, do they need to be stout in a trial, or can it really be the case that that we can look at the record and say, even if you accept what the plaintiff's evidence is, it's not deliberate indifference?
You know, I don't think they're factual disputes. I mean, the record that was submitted by the plaintiff, we asked the plaintiff to give us the names of everybody that was over detained. Who do you have? And we got the list of this. First, it was 37. Then there were 14 more that were identified at the very end of discovery.
But there may be a class. I mean, there may be a class of people. They don't have to bring everybody in.
I
pointed to this JA-779. This is your view of who was detained. Yeah. I mean, some of it is lacking in credibility, it seems to me. Two people in 2011 were held past the release date out of 13,435. Is that your contention, that that's how many people?
I believe that's what was reported by the department.
And then there was 18 in 2000, out of 27,000. Two people in 09 out of 21,000. Doesn't seem to square with the plaintiff's evidence.
Well, Your Honor, the argument that was made in the briefs was that Danbury and McBride did not, and the record doesn't show that. I mean, they did take affirmative steps here.
Why don't you tell us about that? Why don't you explain what was done to address the problems?
That's in
the record, yeah.
The steps that Danbury took were to organize the central kind of records in one central office. We don't agree with the record.
That can't be the step, right? Because the argument is CORE made it worse, not better. So we start with CORE. We don't say CORE is the step that made it better. CORE is, according to them, the problem. So you can't advance the ball by pointing to CORE. So what do you got after the establishment of CORE?
Well, after the establishment of CORE, McBride also, they started having a formal training program for everyone who worked there for 6 months. The hours of the office are open from 5 in the morning till 10 at night. They are staffed 24/7 with supervisors. It's not
what of the argument that they won't answer the phone? That we've got affidavits and testimony from people saying they will not answer the phone. They may be open, but nobody knows it because you're stuck in voicemail hell because they won't answer the phone.
I think there's a disputed fact in that, Your Honor. McBride testified that they do answer the phone, but I think that's a disputed fact.
Okay. So is that a material dispute
fact?
No,
I don't think it is.
If they're open but they're not taking phone calls, people can't get answers, is that immaterial to the question of whether people are deliberately indifferent?
it's immaterial to whether or not somebody is on. I think that they're two separate questions.
Suppose the testimony was there are five people, each of whom has called on multiple occasions at different times of day and night, and no one ever answers the phone. Is that a material fact that creates a genuine dispute?
You know, I still would say there has to be some showing that there's some harm there. But if somebody called and then that delay that led to someone not being released on time.
Well, the harm is that each of these people in my hypothetical have said that the inability to have the phone answered led to over-detention. That's essentially what's happening. Maybe not with the exactitude of the hypothetical, but that's what's happening.
That there's five people that...
No. That the allegation is that, you know, every time we try to get some help to extricate ourselves from the system, the system is set up in such a way that it doesn't permit it.
Is that state a claim against McBride?
Well, at the moment, the only thing we're trying to figure out is whether it creates a genuine dispute, which requires us to send it back.
I would still say it does not. I mean, I think there still has to be some showing.
What would create a genuine dispute in your view?
In my view, and I would go, I cited to the, I think the Marcus case. There can't be speculative evidence about who the plaintiffs are. I mean, there has to be evidence about who's in the class. And I don't think these affidavits support who's in the class. The one is an estimate about who might be overdetained.
When you say, so you're shifting grounds now to the class certification point? I mean, the question we're trying to get you to grapple with is, they have brought forth evidence from people prepared to say the system isn't working and it's not working for an appreciable number of people. 20%, 15%, that's a lot of people when you're processing tens of thousands. A quarter, that's a lot of people. That's their assertion. They say we've got a class of people ready to come in. Chief Judge Stark said, no, there's no deliberate indifference here because they were trying to address problems. They knew they had problems. They were trying to address it. So you could win on that basis if you could point to the record and say, here's why he's right. Here's the things that they're doing that show they weren't deliberately indifferent to the problems. So what were the things they were doing? You've mentioned that they had training. What else you got?
There was also testimony about they established a bail unit in 2013 where these bails were handled in a more expedited manner to approve releases. They have made changes to the computer system to improve the release process.
That's in the record.
I'm sorry?
That's in the record.
It's all in McBride's deposition. Mm-hmm. Staffing on the weekends during the week,
those are changes in staffing, increased staffing.
Overall staffing for the facility, for the office, yes, Sean.
They went from being short staffed to being full staffed.
Well, staffing has been added as during the course of the operation. Casual seasonals have been added. The office has been trained to treat all releases as a priority. They're being trained to report over detentions each day. It's not as if McBride buried her head in the sand here and told her people, don't tell me anything about anybody who's over released.
Okay.
And we have a large...
Well, then let me ask this. Your time's up, but if my colleagues will indulge me, I want to ask you the question that I asked Mr. Hampton. Since this has been filed, has there been anything that's changed to address things like nobody answers the phone, etc.?
No, the one change has been the bail unit that's been established in 2013, which expedites the way these, when someone's bail is changed from secure to unsecured, or if somebody's charges are non-crossed, it's done in a more expedited fashion. So they moved away away from the so-called 24-hour rule, which I think are done in a quicker fashion. As far as the not answering the phone, that's a disputed fact, but certainly anybody can write essential offender records. And then that's in the record. You probably testified that once you get something in records, she investigates it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. McTaggart. Mr. Hampton, your rebuttal, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. The cite to the transcript at 904 is the official rule by the COR that specifically says offenders are not to contact central offender records, they are to contact their counselors. And that is part of the problem that existed from the beginning and has not been fixed. My brief, pages 9, I think 7 through about 11, I went through and specifically pointed out what everybody told me was a problem when they were trying to get their situation fixed. And some of these people were in there for weeks and months, and they were told things like nothing came up on the computer, status didn't change on the computer, they don't have any paperwork, they have 72 hours before we have to release you. These are the answers that the people are getting when they're incarcerated. Because these answers haven't changed, you have the same situation, that whether it is specifically a problem completely internal to COR or whether it's a problem that could be fixed if COR addressed it, the inmates themselves have no way to get this problem out to anyone unless the particular counselors or correctional officers want to make a call. In fact, some of the incidents we went through with Rebecca McBride when we were going through the records, the reason that the person eventually got out is because COR started getting calls from the prison or from the court or from somebody outside saying, why isn't this person out? And those calls are days and even a week down the line. A system where the only way the inmate himself can tell anybody of being wrongfully held here is to try to write a letter to COR. They don't know how many letters they get. They don't know how many of them are complaining about being over detained.
So what should be done?
Well, part of what should be done, I mean, I can say exactly what they did in Barnes and Ward were great, but they list at least five different things in the one case that they did. Things like tracking these releases to see how often they got out, making sure there's somebody who can actually respond if the inmate says, I was in court today and the judge released me, but here I am. And 2 or 3 days later, here I am.
That's a perfectly valid, sensible point. Now, the question that we have to wrestle with is deliberate indifference, right? Because Chief Judge Stark looks at this evidence and he says, given the number of releases handled by CORE each year, it is unsurprising, though of course unfortunate, that errors occur and that prisoners are sometimes over-detained. Some incidents of over-detention occurred is not sufficient by itself to show that McBride was deliberately indifferent to such incidents. To the contrary, McBride demonstrated throughout her deposition she was familiar with the procedures and, quote, was actively working to improve processes. So that's a determination that the district court made looking at the record, saying she's doing something. It may not be what you want. It may not target the thing you'd like to have fixed. It may not address that with specificity you want. But we're dealing with a blunt instrument here in terms of constitutional violations. We don't get to fine-tune things. We can only say when there's a really bad, out-of-whack thing happening, then to get ourselves into it. I take to Chief Judge Stark's remark to be, you're not there. You haven't built the record to show that you're there. You have fine-tuning complaints, but that's it. How is he wrong?
I think, Your Honor, I would disagree with him in that they know these over-detentions are occurring, and there's other case law that says if you know there are over-detentions occurring, and you know you're the one that's going to have to fix it, and you don't do anything that's effectual, that's indifference. That's deliberate indifference. I would point out that even when Amber was being questioned way back, he admitted that the transition has created more confusion.
Sure, any transition will create confusion. When you say they haven't done anything, respond to Mr. McTaggart's assertion that They created a bail unit, specifically to address speeding up bail release. So that doesn't cause anything?
Well, there's no evidence that it did. Number one, there's no evidence that it did. Number two, it's not going to fix the problem where the person is in the prison and they can't get out because somehow the records didn't get to COR or COR.
That is a problem, but that's inherent in any situation where you have the court, you've got different things, and stuff falls through the cracks. I mean, you have that, you know, with defendants supposed to be delivered for trial and something happens and everybody struggles to figure out, but is that an issue of deliberate indifference? I guess that's the question.
What we got to fight with, right?
I'm sorry?
I said that's what we got to fight with, right? It's certainly not ideal. Nobody in this room, even Mr. McTaggart doing his utmost for his client, I'm sure nobody in this room would say the system is functioning flawlessly. The question is it functioning in a way that could be said to represent deliberate indifference on the part of the state of Delaware? And we have your argument on that. Let me finish by just suggesting that I hope the state is at least paying attention. You know, it may not be that legal remedies flow, or maybe they will. You know, maybe we'll get together and say, yeah, deliberate indifference. But however that happens, whether it happens or not, I hope the state is paying attention, and that instead of just saying, well, we think we do answer the phone, somebody's actually paying attention to these things and addressing them. That would take some pressure off, probably, right? Okay. Well, thanks for a well-argued case, and we appreciate both parties' assistance with it. We'll take the matter under advisement, and we'll stand in recess until tomorrow.